years, which have been doing some amazing things, including finding water on the moon, which could potentially be useful for further human exploration, but also for scientific purposes. So as a scientist, you know, it's great to send people if we can afford it and want to do it, but most of the serious science that we want to do is actually with robots.
That's quite interesting, because that puts public engagement actually as a significant factor in this, in your view. Juliet, we last went to the moon in the early 1970s, and since somebody's now said, since you've now said it'll be 50 years, it makes me feel really old. Why haven't we been back since then in terms of manned or personed exploration?
Well, first of all, it's quite expensive to do a mission like this. Also, when we had gone to the moon previously, there was a sort of finish line goal that was achieved. Now, what we're trying to do now is quite different. So it's not about necessarily knowledge accumulation or just going to the moon as a visit, but rather a sustained presence. And so this is quite a different mission than we saw 50 years ago, as you mentioned. Our set of motives have also changed. So I think we can sort of categorize this as exploration, sort of expansion, exploitation, and eventually exclusion. And there's a whole host of motives that have evolved since the last time that we had done moon missions.
Okay, unpick some of those for me. There's an awful lot of EXs.
Yeah, so that came from Joshua P. Carlson's research. Exploration is essentially sort of going out there collecting data and knowing specifically what we're going to be dealing with when we go to celestial bodies. Expansion is sort of what we're seeing with the Artemis program, so sort of planting ourselves there. This is a bit of a lily pad. So once we've planted ourselves on the moon, then we can sort of consider broader missions. Exploitation will be what we're looking at in terms of resources, so being able to mine on celestial bodies. And then exclusion, those who had the capital to do this in the early stages, in the early days, then sort of, I guess, excluding others from joining that space club, so to speak.
The fact remains, though, that we haven't wanted to put people there for 50 years, and that therefore something else has changed in the kind of mindset, Libby.
Yeah, well, the last 50 years, we have figured out how to live and work in space. Apollo was a sprint. It was an amazing, very expensive accomplishment that happened back in the 60s and 70s. And as Julia said, once that finish line was made, once the US had proven to the world that they were better than the Soviet Union, they went, we don't need to spend that money. And actually, horizons narrowed to the science that we could do, to the benefits that we could draw from living and working in low Earth orbit. We've had humans on the International Space Station continuously since 2000. They've been carrying out science, research, developing new materials, understanding things that are all benefiting everybody back here on Earth. But we've managed to do that now. The International Space Station is coming towards the end of its life. We're looking to commercial space stations, what will take over there. And so the focus has shifted to what, as a species, can we figure out how to do next? And the next goal, to my mind, is can we figure out how to live and work on another planetary body? Now, Mars, really long way away. The Moon, 250,000 miles, 2 days away, 3 days away, much closer. And that's where our exploration focus is.
Andrew, Libby mentioned the space station. Can you remind us how many space stations there are up there, how many astronauts there are up in the space station, and what they're actually doing now?
Well, right at the moment, yes, there are 7 astronauts on the International Space Station. There is another space station as well, a Chinese space station, with 3 people on that as well. So these people are low Earth orbit, which, for those that are not familiar, that means about 400 kilometres above our heads, something like that. So it's less than the distance from London to Edinburgh. But what they're doing is using microgravity. So that's, of course, it's in orbit, so you're in sort of constant free fall around the Earth. So microgravity is an important thing for scientific experiments, trying to understand, as Libby said, you know, if we want to go further, then understanding how the body works in that environment, potentially getting new materials and that sort of thing. That's the type of research that they're doing. And also working out how to collaborate in space. But for me, you know, they're not going very far. And actually, the main exploration with unmanned probes. We've been able to go to, not only the Moon, but of course Mars and Saturn. We had the Cassini mission to Saturn a few years ago. The Voyager spacecraft have left our solar system, the electromagnetic edge of the solar system. So for the real exploration of space and the real understanding of space and the science of space, it's better to go further and understand that. However, the human exploration does have a role, certainly with inspiration and so on.
Libby, you were a flight director for the International Space Station. I can't not ask you, what did that involve?
It's just like the movies. If anyone has seen Apollo 13, that's a very good representation. And indeed, for the Artemis missions, people are flying back to the moon. But I was a flight director for the International Space Station, specifically for the European Space Agency's part of that, the Columbus module. And so we would work shifts. There was teams of us. We were there for 8 hours a day. And our job is to keep the space station flying, keep the crew safe, respond to problems, and keep everybody moving along the timeline, cracking on with doing the experiments, the maintenance, the exercise, the public outreach that happens every day. It's an amazing role. You have to know how the International Space Station works. You have to be prepared for problems. You stay calm if there is an emergency or a situation that arises. And you have a ringside seat, all this fantastic science and exploration that's taking place.
What kind of problems did you find yourself having to solve?
Day to day, we would have experiments that didn't quite go according to plan, or computers that would stop working and you really would just turn them off and on again. But occasionally bigger parts of the space station would break, something that is distributing power to the whole space station, all the cooling loops. And the whole teams all around the world, in the US, in Europe, Canada and Russia and Japan, would have to come together and figure out how to keep the space station running.
Julia, let's look at something that you mentioned earlier. I suppose what we're talking about here are some of the kind of material benefits we might conceivably get, already have got, from space exploration. How do we use space and the technology that's now up there in our daily lives?
So space technology is ubiquitous in our everyday lives. GPS was a military invention, but we use that every day to get from one point to another. Agriculture infrastructure uses space systems in order to occupy fields and make sure that everything is used to the 10th degree. We use them in our timestamps for baking and ATMs. So really, it's part of our everyday infrastructure. There's spin-off and spin-out technologies that have also been quite useful. The ways in which we charge our hearing aids, those batteries, are something that came from the Apollo missions. Shock absorbers and bridges also came from Apollo. And I don't know if anyone's run the London Marathon recently, but those sort of heat blankets, those came from Apollo as well.
So take one of those examples, let's say the shock absorbers in bridges. What on Apollo did they do that then got applied to shock absorbers in bridges?
Developing the landing infrastructure for the modules. So realizing that had great utility in sort of settling the module and then applying that to Earth and seeing where that might actually have a benefit for us here.
Andrew, there's even a name at the moment talking about utility to put a nuclear reactor on the moon. Why would you possibly want to do that?
Well, if people are going to be exploring on the lunar surface, one thing about the moon is it has a very long night. So it's sort of 2 weeks. As the moon goes around the Earth, you have a sort of 2 week day and 2 week night, roughly. So having power, which is not solar power, would be important if we were going to potentially have a sort of lunar village or a lunar base, which eventually the Artemis program may be heading towards.
Libby.
Rolls-Royce here in the UK have been developing a reactor, and it's about the size, perhaps, of a large car. That's one way to look at it. It has to be relatively small because you have to get it there. We've got in the Science Museum a model of one of the concept models that Rolls-Royce have been developing for nuclear reactors.
Julian, who are now the key players in space? Obviously the United States. And is there still a space race? I mean, essentially, are the Americans and Chinese doing what the Americans and Russians and Soviet Union were doing back in the 60s?
If we look at the US as sort of the established space power, there's a lot in terms of strategic culture that drives the US missions. We could probably even root it back to the frontier thesis about expansion or understanding Americans' place in the world or in the universe. But if we look at Russia, for example, that was an established space power that we see now as sort of a declining power. Partially because of war in Europe that's going on at the moment, but also because of the infrastructure that they weren't able to sort of sustain. So with the ISS deorbiting, Russia has ambitions to develop its own space station, but there's skepticism as to what extent Russia can remain a strong actor. So perhaps in Russia's stead, we're seeing China rise, partially because China sees science and technology investment as part of its plans for, as they call it, world domination, but rather that's essentially undermining American hegemony. They have plans for space domination by, I believe, 2045. But these ambitions are essentially about becoming large actors in the space domain and being able to shape governance to suit them the best. So I'd say those are the three largest actors at the moment.
Okay, so let's just take a concrete example, and it's the old concrete example. Which one is now hoping to land people on the moon, and by when?